Hello, I'm Rachel Babin from Oncology News Australia, proud producers of the OJC Meets. In this episode, Craig Underhill speaks candidly with Julie McCrossin AM. Julie is a well-known Australian comedian, broadcaster, podcaster, advocate, and cancer survivor. This episode is a perfect example of the OJC Meets series. We laughed, we cried, we felt inspired. This intimate conversation covers everything from oral sex to radiation oncology masks to the care of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patients. As always, you'll find links to the papers, resources, bios and Twitter handles in the notes on our website. For regular news and podcast updates, subscribe to the Oncology Newsletter on oncologynews.com.au. It's free and it's a great way to support the OJC. This is Rachel Babin and this is the Oncology Podcast.
So it's my absolute pleasure to welcome Julie McCrossin onto the OJC Meet series. Julie, it's wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on. Julie is Julie McCrossin AM, so she has the Order of Australia Medal for her advocacy, especially in the LGBTQI domain. And we'll come back and talk a little bit about that. Julie is a broadcaster. She is a cancer survivor. She's become a cancer advocate and she does a lot of work in the health field. So we're going to touch on those subjects today. So, Julie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No, it's a privilege. Thanks, Craig.
I was reading about you and you've got a Wikipedia page, which I was impressed with. And I wanted to start back at the start of your journey, if you like. And, of course, you became involved in the gay liberation movement in the 70s when you were at Sydney University. So firstly, can you remember what you were studying at university in the 70s?
Of course. Look, I went to Sydney University in 1972 and I was studying arts law and ultimately finished an arts degree and a primary dip ed and went into children's theatre. But back in the 90s, I went to the University of New South Wales and finished the law. So, yes, I was in the full flush of activism in the 1970s at Sydney University.
It must have been an amazing time, sort of exciting, but I think at times probably a bit scary as well. So you referred to as one of the 78ers. So can you explain what that means?
Well, look, in essence, in 1978, there was a demonstration at which 53 people were arrested at King's Cross in Sydney. That was a very violent demonstration with the police. And that's known as the beginning of what became the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras, which is now, I think, the largest community event in Australia, if certainly in the, you know, one of the largest community events, and now has police and defence and public servants and health marching in it. But it began as a violent protest. So I was one of the people involved in demonstrations asking for the decriminalisation of homosexuality and equal non-discrimination in a nutshell. And that began really in the very early 70s. So 1978 was just one of many, many periods of demonstrations. But can I just say, Craig, I don't remember it with fear and anxiety at all. You know, homosexuality wasn't decriminalised in New South Wales, where I grew up, until 1983. It wasn't decriminalised in Tasmania until the 90s. So to be part of the historic struggle for equity that has now sees, you know, we've had a lesbian woman as head of the Australian Medical Association. We have, we've had senior politicians and members of cabinet who are openly gay and married. And, you know, to have been able to live through that period of social change and to see progress, openly gay people on the High Court of Australia, for example, has been a thrilling thing. And it's not irrelevant to advocacy about cancer. You know, I was unlucky enough to be diagnosed with stage 4 HPV-related oropharyngeal cancer in 2013 and lucky enough to survive. And like so many other cancer survivors, I felt drawn to try to improve healthcare for those head and neck cancer patients who follow after me. And the skills and experience I had as an activist with gay liberation and women's liberation in the 70s and 80s inform what I do now. And critical among that is the forming of partnerships across the community. And so as a cancer advocate for head and neck cancer patients in particular, you know, I've been thrilled to find change makers in the multidisciplinary cancer teams and to work in partnership. And those skills come from those early days at Sydney University.
Yeah, fantastic. And we might come back to that partnerships issue. But I was worried about mentioning HPV and oral sex. And, and I didn't need to worry because you just came right out and said it.
The great advantage of having been a gay activist is that I lived through that period, that appalling period of HIV/AIDS. I saw loads of men in particular die, but I saw the health system rise to the occasion. And I have emceed hundreds of events to do with AIDS. And we produced the most graphic and blunt educational materials about the prevention of transmission of HIV. And that's how I'm proud of our nation and proud of our health system. So I can draw on that history. I'm not ashamed of being gay and I'm not ashamed of having oral sex. Look, can I tell you one quick anecdote? So I was invited down to Tasmania by the Cancer Council. I told my story and said I got it from oral sex. There would have been 350 people in the room and you could have heard a pin drop. There was a look of astonishing shock. And I just remember I've been a comedian. So, you know, you see all of life when you're in the comedy circuit in Australia. And I just laughed and I said, goodness me, I'm not the only person in Tasmania today who's had oral sex. And, of course, the place exploded with laughter because that was a self-evident truth. So I think that unique experience of having been a gay activist, of supporting the prevention of HIV and the frank educational materials necessary to achieve that, and then having that quirky history as a comedian, including on that old media show Good News Week, funnily enough, prepared me to be an HPV-related oropharyngeal cancer advocate. It's not something I've chosen, but this is the hand life dealt me, and I want to make a contribution.
I guess the fear and anxiety was referring to the fact that it was illegal, it was new. You were locked up during that time, is that right? You spent time in jail. So I would have thought that was pretty scary.
Look, I guess I had a gift given to me. It wasn't something I developed myself. My gift was that while I thought I might be a lesbian from about the age of 13, I did have boyfriends whom I loved and cared for greatly. So I would have described myself as bisexual in the 60s and early 70s. But I did think I might be a lesbian. And while I was frightened because I was told it was against God's will, it was a mental illness, and it was unlawful for men and somehow by implication not good for women either. So obviously that was a burden, particularly as a teenager. I never could believe that that was right. It just felt okay. And maybe I was able through my parents who were good people who'd been active in the Second World War and done brave, good things. And I went to really good Anglican girls' schools that I loved. And I met a lot of people who of faith and goodwill who worked hard to make the world a better place. I felt like a good person and that the world needed to change. And funnily enough, there were aspects of my treatment as a head and neck cancer patient where I thought, these are good people, my multidisciplinary team, but there's aspects of this care that really needs to be improved. And again, I hope I have humility and I'm not some sort of egomaniac, but I do have a strong sense of justice and I've been able to play a part in progressive change.
And so things have moved along quite a lot in terms of gay rights and marriage equality. And I read that, you know, you went from being the first gay and lesbian Mardi Gras in King's Cross and then harassed by the police, et cetera, to hosting on, you know, free-to-air television, the coverage of the parade, which is now like, you know, everything's favourite thing to do on a Saturday night in January. And then we had the plebiscite in Australia, and I was quite pessimistic at the time with whether that would get up because I thought that the government was playing silly buggers with the rules. That wasn't a pun. With the rules around, you know, a really probably like the Republican vote, trying to maybe get it squashed and it, you know, it would not come out that all the states would be in favour. So where were you on that day when it was announced, and how did you feel on that day? Was that a great sort of vindication of all the things that you'd fought for?
Look, it meant the world to me, Craig. I actually don't remember exactly where I was, to be honest with you, but that could be cisplatin, even though I adore chemotherapy and it enhanced my radiation and I'm alive 8 years later. I do think I have a little bit of memory loss. That could be aging, but there could be a touch of cisplatin. I shouldn't say that to medical oncologists. I love what you dripped into my veins.
I think we do sort of accept that term chemotherapy for Julie.
But look, I should tell you this story. I had always wanted to get married for a really long time. I've jokingly referred to myself as the friendly suburban face of Australian lesbianism, in that my aspirations have always been to have a happy family, and I'm very lucky now to be married to my partner, Melissa Gibson. And I've helped her raise, with their dad, Michael, two children who I met when they were 4 and 7. And Amelia, our daughter, is now a general practitioner in Adelaide, where I'm living now, helping with her first baby, our granddaughter, Billy, and she's pregnant with a second child. So I'm very much a nana living in suburbia, learning how to use the Woolies online grocery orders. But I wanted to get married, and I always said I'll wait till it's legal in Australia. But I was sitting at the Kinghorn Cancer Centre in 2013 with some cisplatin dripping into my veins. My partner Melissa was there with me. I suddenly thought, my God, I might not live long enough to see us get married in Australia, because we had, I won't go into that because I guess I'd rather talk about cancer, but let's just say I wasn't sure I'd live long enough to see it happen. And so I said to Melissa, look, if I survive this, let's go to New York and get married. Let's not wait for Australia. And I did survive it. And in 2014, we flew to New York. Our children came with us. One of my brothers, who's a dermatologist on the south coast of New South Wales, he flew to New York as well, which meant the world to me. And we got married in Manhattan. And the woman said, oh, my God, there's so many Aussies coming over here. You know, we got on with it. A lot of us got on with it. But it did mean the world to me. For this reason, from 13 till 18, I didn't hear a good word about homosexuality. And that was a torment. And the truth is, that's still happening in Australia. It's happening in multicultural communities and in some faith communities. And obviously that's a hot topic in Australian politics at the moment. And so to me, the key of our success in justice for rainbow people, as I like to call them, there's too many letters, the key has been coming out, the individuals being open and being open in their communities and getting known. And I think it's the same for HPV-related head and neck cancer, because over 5,000 people a year in Australia are diagnosed with head and neck cancer, and your audience will know that's historically predominantly been men, a good two-thirds men, and it's been predominantly smokers and heavy drinkers. But there's this new it's been called an epidemic, and I'll leave it to your clinical people to get the right terminology, but they're certainly calling that in the United States. There is an explosion of HPV-related head and neck cancer, and it's because of oral sex, and we know it's also penile, anal, vulval. And very few people know about it. Even our general practitioners critically are not sufficiently familiar with the symptoms and its rising incidence. And I see a link between your interest in my gay history and my current cancer advocacy. And the link is this: individuals being able to say, yes, I've had oral sex, and I was in that tiny, unlucky minority where my immune system did not work, like, as I understand it, the vast majority of people's immune system does, is that something like 80% plus of the population will get HPV of one kind or another, and then just a tiny percentage of us at a population level, we get the couple of the dangerous HPV variations, and it gets lodged down the bottom of our throat somewhere, and we get, you know, some years later, this appalling cancer with a very tough treatment and long-term side effects. And until more people like me are able to just calmly say, yes, oral sex can cause this. And yes, in the 70s and 80s, we started to have it a bit more evidently, us baby boomers, than had been historically the case. And even though the HPV vaccine is going to protect, thank goodness, my grandchildren, we know that people who haven't had that HPV vaccine at school, so that's people about 30 and up, we've got a good 40 to 50 years of HPV-related oropharyngeal cancer turning up. And my passion is raising awareness about that.
So it's fantastic to hear you talking like that, because there is still a stigma. You know, I go to a head and neck multidisciplinary meeting, and when we have discussions with patients, if they bring it up, you know, what causes it, we'll have a frank discussion. There is still that little bit of this stigma about it. And so, you know, all power to you for, again, using your circumstances to advocate for better treatments for others. So my last question on gay marriage, you've kind of answered, and then we'll go on to the health advocacy and cancer. But it was like, is the war won? Is there more to do? And, of course, we've seen in recent weeks in Australia the inverted commas religious discrimination bill being debated. And I still think there, as you say, there's still pockets of discrimination, and there's this sort of ongoing, as in every issue, there's an ongoing battle between the progressives and the conservatives, and the progressives move things along, the conservatives want to claw it back.
Look, I'm a great believer in sharing the positive. And so what I want to say to you is that I'm a Christian woman. I'm a member of South Sydney Uniting Church in Sydney. I now attend it by Zoom, which has been fantastic for me because, as I said, I'm living in Adelaide being a nana. But I've learnt to run a Zoom meeting and often host the Zoom. So I'm a member of the Uniting Church. I'm an active member. I've been an elder in my own parish. And the Uniting Church in Australia ordains gay men and women and indeed transgender people. And we also leave it to individual parishes, and if they wish, they can marry within the church. I went to Skeggs Darlinghurst. Now, that's an Anglican high school in Sydney, but it is a progressive Anglican high school. And so during the Mardi Gras months, the playground at Darlinghurst, where I spent 6 incredibly happy years, flies the rainbow flag during that period. And the principal of that school, Jenny Allam, and she's been public about this in the media and in written material to the school, she welcomes gay or transgender or thinking children, rainbow students, parents and teachers. And it's my experience as an openly gay woman for many, many years, well, since I was 18, to be honest with you, I've been invited to be, you know, be speech night person at Catholic schools and all sorts of faith schools. So the good news is, and I think the vote for marriage equality showed where the Australian population is sitting. However, that's the good news. The sadder news is that the literally almost all the faith groups in Australia, Jewish, Islamic and Christian, so the Abrahamic faiths, their leadership, almost to an every one of them, is still believes that homosexuality is not acceptable and that the only way forward is to not have a relationship. So they've reached the point where they say, you exist to be part of our community, you must not have a relationship. And that's a great sadness to me because I think it's incredibly cruel. That's the leadership, and I don't think it's the general population. Even in Islamic community in Australia, there are imams and certainly families who accept their children. And I'll tell you one of the saddest things, just because you're on this topic, there's a group called PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Lesbian and Gays, and I've been a speaker at these meetings, and these are families who come together and talk about their own family experience and try to support each other, because it's not just the person who might be rainbow that has to come out, families come out. And one of the saddest meetings I ever went was opposite Westmead Hospital in a community hall, Parents and Friends of Lesbian and Gays in Western Sydney. Almost everybody in the audience was multicultural and people were sobbing. You know, there are communities where the homosexual sons are still bashed up by family members. You know, it's a dishonour to the family. And so the fact that the Catholic Church still has homosexuality is intrinsically disordered, the fact that the Sydney Anglicans, not all Anglicans, are world leaders in saying rainbow people should not have relationships for life, and they align with the African churches, where there are still many countries where there are criminal or even death penalties for homosexuality. This is a great sadness to me. But I'm an optimist and I'll bat on, just like I will with head and neck.
Yeah, well, that's right. So the change has been enormous. I think it's really important for the medical people listening, you know, to take on that advocacy role, not necessarily about this issue, but, and we've talked about it a few times on our journal club. There's been some articles about the importance of doctors and medical staff being advocates. There was a New England Journal paper last year called Taking Back Our Voices, hashtag humanity is our lane. So we're in a fairly privileged position. I've always taken on that idea that we can do things as an individual patient level, but we can also do things at a system level and an advocacy level. And I think it's really important. You get, if you put your head above the parapet, you put yourself open to criticism and for taking a knock. But I think it's really important that we all do that.
Oh, Craig, I think Australia, if we look at how we dealt with HIV/AIDS, we have a magnificent internationally leading example of people affected by that condition, which obviously is potentially everyone, but in the initial days, self-injecting drug users and gay men, partnering with health administrators and multidisciplinary clinicians to do systemic change, world-leading education. And to me, that is a fantastic model for what needs to happen with the HPV-related epidemic connected to oral sex. I know someone who has anal cancer as a result of anal sex and HPV, and I'm not aware of anyone talking openly about that. And yet, how will people know to quickly get to their general practitioner and persist in reporting their symptoms? And then if they're general practitioner does not refer them, in my case, to an ENT surgeon, and sadly my GP did not, even though I had the classic symptoms. I had a persistent sore throat and I wasn't sick. I had a very severe earache and I had two lumps on the side of my neck. They are core classic oropharyngeal cancer symptoms. I was at a leading general practice where they do training and all the rest of it. I was never referred. And fortunately, I'd had a prior connection to an ENT surgeon called Associate Professor Richard Gallagher at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, because I had some voice issues as a professional voice user on the radio, and I'd had contact with him. And so I wrote him a personal letter. He saw me immediately, and I was in treatment 8 days later with 33 sessions of radiation and weekly chemo. But if I hadn't written that letter, I'm not sure I'd be doing this interview with you.
Wow, that's incredible. How did you feel when you were diagnosed?
Oh, astonishingly shocked, because I hadn't drunk at all, literally no alcohol since 1979. I've been a non-drinker completely since 1979 because I was in trouble with alcohol in the 70s. And similarly, I'd stopped smoking around 79, 81. So I didn't know. I'd never heard of HPV causing oropharyngeal cancer or any of the other cancers. The only one I knew was cervical cancer. And there's a group now called Head and Neck Cancer Australia, and I'll give a link to your listeners, which is put together by a multidisciplinary clinical group with patient support and family support, a brilliant website with information for both clinicians, patients and families. And they're just to put together a submission to the Australian government for 2022 to improve resources, to improve the care and research and information around head and neck cancer. And the important thing about that Head and Neck Cancer Australia website is that it didn't exist back in 2013 when I was diagnosed. So I'm not aware of any information that was out there to prepare me for the experience that a non-drinking, non-smoker could get throat cancer. And, you know, that's why I'm so passionate about raising awareness, particularly with general practitioners, to be honest, because they're the gateway for patients to care.
Last night I clicked on a link of the Targeting Cancer series, and I watched one of the YouTube clips. I think it was number 3 of the 5 or 6 that he did. And I was just transfixed, Julie. They're actually really wonderful videos. And then I had to go back and watch them all. So that's what I did last night. Instead of watching Q&A, I watched those. And it was fantastic because, firstly, your warmth and your compassion comes across. and your excellent communication skills. There's a couple of times where I got quite a little bit emotional, actually, because your emotion came through, and you talked about, like, we're going to talk about the mask. I think we have to talk about the mask, about the anxiety involved with making the mask and wearing the mask. That was particularly interesting. And I think I would advocate for anyone listening who is not aware of the actual process of the making of the mask and the wearing of the mask. I'd seen it during my training, but it was a stark reminder about, you know, it's actually not easy having the radiotherapy for head and neck cancer.
Could I just quickly recap for people who are not familiar with the Targeting Cancer campaign and that website? So I'm a voluntary advocate for Head and Neck Cancer Australia Targeting Cancer campaign, which is run by the Faculty of Radiation Oncology in the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Radiology, and also for TROG, Fight Cancer, a research group in radiation therapy. But coming back to the Targeting Cancer campaign, it's essentially a brilliant campaign by the college to raise awareness in the community generally, but also among clinicians, of the sophisticated contemporary radiation therapy and its highly targeted nature. And the fact that I'm talking to you now, that I've got saliva, that I can swallow, that I have fewer dental problems than many of my colleagues, is a tribute to the fact of the very targeted nature of the radiation I had. And anyway, I was approached, I think it was the same year that I was treated in 2013, it might have been early 2014, by Associate Professor Sandra Turner, who was at that stage the clinical lead of that campaign and producing material for the website, and said, would you be a voluntary ambassador? And I said, absolutely, I'll do whatever you want. You know, radiation and chemo have saved my life. Who wouldn't want to promote and raise awareness? But in return, would you help me get across the message that we need to improve the education and preparation of patients and family for the mask experience? Because when you have radiation therapy to the head and neck, or indeed for the brain as well, you need this, they call it the immobilization mask. It's a personally made mask that's rigid, and you're clicked down onto the bed of the radiation machine. And I'm a brave, confident person, and I was asked if I was claustrophobic, but I didn't think I was. You know, I'd even done bushwalks and caving and all sorts of things, but of course I'd never had a stage 4 cancer diagnosis and then been clicked down by the head and left alone in a room while a big machine whirred around me for 20 minutes. And the good news is that Sandra took me into my bunker. We got permission to go back into my bunker. They filmed me making a mask. They filmed me on the Linac going in to have the radiation done. It wasn't for real, but we showed what it looked like. And she just did the most amazing interview with me. And I just sat on my Linac with my mask and really said all the things that I wished I'd known and seen. And I think you've got to see it to believe it, because cancer treatment can be a little bit like an episode of Doctor Who. So I showed and said everything I wish I'd known. We cut them up into 6 little videos. It's called Julie's Story Targeting Cancer, if people Google it, and we'll give you a link. And it's on that website, and they've had over 35,000 shares. The one that's had the most views by far is the one on the making of the immobilization mask. And it's had over 30,000 views.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you mentioned in that, you know, you had to take 2.5 milligrams of diazepam or lorazepam, and there were 4 songs that got you through. Do you remember the 4 songs?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. Look, could I explain that what you're referring to now is I had 4 days of treatment, 20 minutes left alone in the room, so that's not counting the setup. I did keep asking for help, and I honestly, Craig, I still don't understand why my radiation therapist didn't help me, because I got to know them well, and it was odd that they didn't let me know that there were strategies to cope. But at the end of the 4th session, I went and saw my nurse in the radiation treatment center, and I said, I can't go back in there. And she said, oh, for God's sake, Jill, why didn't you speak up? You know, a lot of people have to be stoned off their heads, if I could quote her directly, to cope with this. You know, we can get some Valium for you and it'll help you out. And but what I found was I just had
Literally 2.5 milligrams of Valium. I listened to the same four songs, and they were four songs from Simply Red. And I don't seek them out. But they soothed me, and they were the exact duration of my treatment because, of course, you can't see a clock. You don't know how long you're in for. And also the nurse came in and held my hand for the next few times they clicked me down. I've since travelled Australia and the world to see how other people prepare head and neck cancer patients for the mask, including children, because it's not good for children to have a general anaesthetic every time they have this treatment. And there's a fantastic thing at St James University Hospital in Leeds in the United Kingdom, where I travelled because they do such good preparation, where they've built a scale model of their actual LINAC, and they put Barbie and Ken on it, and it moves, and they show children and anxious adults, and obviously I am around the mask, but I'll come back to some research on that in a minute, and they show it to us because seeing it helps prepare you. But they've got this really simple thing where they have a long coloured string, and the child holds one end of it, and they put this long string back out into the waiting area where the mother, father, or family member is, and you can tug it while you're there. It's a connection. Now, when I saw that, honestly, Craig, that would have helped me. I was never alone. There was always someone outside.
But not that they're tugging on the end of the cord to say everything's okay.
Exactly. So there's many strategies in place, but it goes to this question of insufficient attention in cancer treatment generally to what I've now learnt to call psychosocial well-being, but let's call it emotional well-being. And what emerges is that there's been precious little research into the emotional experience of patients during the wearing of the mask. Sandra Turner invited me to speak at a medical physics conference in Sydney, and a man called Professor Paul Keel, who's a medical physicist at the ImageX Institute at the University of Sydney, heard me speak, and he came up to me. I had my mask and I explained what had happened, and he said, "We need to adapt the technology to the patient, not bolt the patient to the technology." And he has gone on to form a multidisciplinary team at the ImageX Institute. He's got funding from Cancer Australia. We've also done crowdfunding, and we're going to do it again. And he's developing an alternative technology to the mask. There are radiation oncologists on the team, these amazing medical physicists, scientists, IT whizzes. He's got Professor Phyllis Bhutto, Associate Professor Harriana Dillon. They're in the team. And it's going to take a while, but I think they're going to do it. I think they're going to pull off an alternative safety option to what I call the safety mask. Why not call it the safety mask that a lot of men and women who have jobs, they know about occupational health and safety. Even calling it immobilization is cruel, because who wants to be immobilized by the head?
And for those who aren't aware, the whole idea is that there should be no movement at all, so that you're getting the radiation to the target. But if we can find an alternative method to achieve that without having to put what looks like something out of medieval torture chamber, you know, to put it bluntly, then if they can achieve that, how fantastic would that be?
And could I say, Craig, it's really important to say that in my public advocacy, my public-facing advocacy, I always say I wore that mask to save my life, and I would still wear that mask to save my life. But what I'm advocating for is, before we develop an alternative option, we need to prepare the patient and the family for the experience, not just let us cope as best we can, because Harriana Dillon and Phyllis Bhutto, these two psycho-oncologists, have done some research which will be published shortly. It's on the cusp of publication. It shows that up to 50% of head and neck cancer patients experience clinically relevant anxiety. It's been under-researched. And why I mentioned family, if I could just put in a word for family, radiation therapy is predominantly an outpatient experience. So the fact that I didn't spend a day in hospital in my period of treatment, and I lost 20 kilograms in 6 weeks because your swallowing mechanism is damaged. I lost speech. I was clearly psychologically in trouble. And I was just sent home with my partner, and she had to cope along with everything else. And so it's not just we don't do enough to prepare the patient for the emotional side, but it's also some of the physical care of head and neck cancer. We don't do enough for the family member.
Yeah, and it's hard at the moment because of the COVID-19 pandemic and lockdowns, and often the partners can't come to consultations, and, you know, it is difficult. When I look back in 20 years that I've been a consultant, you know, the kind of supports we have now compared to 20 years ago is quite enormous, but there's still, as you say, a long way to go. I can tell you a little story too. I didn't know that I was claustrophobic until I had to have an MRI. My neck, had neck pain. It was all fine. But I freaked out in the MRI machine and couldn't do it. And they said, oh, this is normal, you know. Come back tomorrow and we'll give you a lorazepam. My triggering song is Angus and Julia Stone, Take a Ride on a Big Jet Plane. That was playing on the headphones while I was having this freak out in the MRI machine, so I can't listen to that song anymore. And it's surprising, I'm talking to the radiology people, oh, no, this is really prevalent. But it's like there's no, as you say, there's no kind of like coaching.
Craig, thank you for sharing that story because it goes to the heart of the matter. As we all know, a significant proportion of patients find certain diagnostic or treatment procedures traumatic. And that's the appropriate word. It's a continuum, but that's the word. Why do we not do preparatory work so that we do not traumatize patients? And I'll just, because I like to be optimistic, right, and constructive, I say look to pediatrics. We don't do to children what we do to adults. So let me get specific. There are many cancer treatment centres that have developed scale models of MRI machines and other of Linacs and other diagnostic and treatment mechanisms in cancer, and they prepare children for it, and they actively involve the parents in it, and they try to support children because lots of sedation isn't good for the developing brain of children. So we need to respect the mental well-being of adult patients as much as children. And again, we need to find the clinical teams where there is a willingness and a consciousness about the importance of emotional well-being, mental health. The work that I do is to interview and film multidisciplinary clinicians and their patients about really innovative, good supportive work in both treatment and in the psychosocial support, and then use social media to promote that. And so I made a series for SAMRI, the South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute, about the coming of proton therapy to Australia, which will be, you know, they're building the Bragg Centre for Proton Therapy and Research in Adelaide right now. And I was asked to make some videos about how they're preparing patients, what is proton therapy and how they're improving the experience for patients and families in the United Kingdom and in Denmark, which I did. But I said, really, proton therapy is just a kind of radiation therapy, so why don't we make some videos about really good work at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre, at Princess Alexandra Cancer Centre, at Crown Princess Mary Cancer Centre. And they said yes. And so, again, I've made a series of videos and I'll give you a link about how to improve the patient experience. And we share some of these really great strategies so that people aren't left traumatized after their treatment.
And I'm aware you're developing some specific information about dental issues.
Yes.
Patients, is that right?
Oh, look, Craig, thanks for raising that, because what's really important about head and neck cancer is in cancer, correct me if I'm wrong, at 5 years, there's a line is drawn. So I had intensive follow-up up to 5 years, and then I'm let loose into the community. You're sort of technically cured. And we know that's better.
Yeah, that's a rough rule of thumb for most cancers. Some have a longer follow-up, but there's obviously late effects.
And with head and neck cancer, our effects get worse after 5 years. And the really critical area is dental. And because when we built our public health system, Medicare, did not include the mouth in Medicare in terms of dental, that has had a catastrophic effect on head and neck cancer patients. So for World Head and Neck Cancer Day, which is in July, I, in partnership with Associate Professor Richard Gallagher, the ENT surgeon who diagnosed me and sent me off to radiation and chemo for my treatment at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney. We made a series of videos about the dental needs of head and neck cancer patients, and I interviewed Dr. Nick Andrews, who's a dentist who works at three leading Sydney hospitals in their cancer teams, working with the head and neck cancer patients. And the truth is, we're still doing what they call full mouth clearances for head and neck cancer patients before radiation treatment. I think we'll come in the future to look back on this as an astonishing trauma to patients. And that's because an assessment is made of the inability or unlikelihood of that patient being able to care for their teeth post-radiation because it damages saliva short, medium, and long-term. It varies. The more precise radiation is much better, and I've got saliva, but it depends a little bit where your tumour is. But it's common to do 7 extractions, 8 extractions, and I don't think if we had public dentistry, one, our teeth wouldn't be in such bad nick by the time we turn up with head and neck cancer. Two, people would be able to afford to manage their teeth later. So Richard Gallagher, as an ENT surgeon, is saying we need to have Medicare-funded dental care for 5 years and beyond for head and neck cancer patients. Another special needs dentist in Adelaide, Associate Professor Sharon Liberale, is another great advocate. She does all the head and neck cancer public patients here in South Australia and coordinates their care with general dentists later. And she too is an advocate for Medicare-funded dental care. So the good news is some dentists and some cancer clinicians are advocating for head and neck cancer patients, but, you know, we need more support. We need more awareness.
Yeah, fantastic. So the last sort of topic I wanted to cover, Julie, was Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with cancer. So, and you've interviewed me for a podcast series about some of the local work we've done with our Aboriginal controlled health organisations locally, which I'm very proud of. I think this is one of the last great frontiers in cancer medicine in Australia, is that we know what the problems are. We now need to start doing some work to tackle that. But we met at a fundraiser for a local Aboriginal woman and artist, Leonie Wilson, at a gallery in Albury. You probably don't remember, but I think you were the host that night. And then we've had this contact through the podcast. Do you agree?
Oh, very much so. Could I say to your listeners, and again, we'll give them a link, that Samri supported me to make a webinar on how can we close the gap in cancer. And I interviewed you as part of that because Aboriginal controlled health services have a critical role to play in supporting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, particularly Aboriginal people, to be diagnosed and get access to treatment and to support them through what for many of us can be a tough cancer experience. And in that webinar, again, to highlight some of the good work that's being done, the Albury Wodonga Aboriginal Controlled Health Service does fantastic work linking with your Albury Wodonga Cancer Centre to support patients, picking them up, going to appointments with them, supporting them through their treatment. Transport is so critical for the underprivileged. A man called Associate Professor Michael Penniment, who's a radiation oncologist who's critical in establishing the Alan Walker Centre for Radiation Therapy up in Darwin. He works closely with the Royal Adelaide Hospital, and they have a specialist Aboriginal unit there to ensure that that big area of Central Australia, Aboriginal people are supported for diagnosis, treatment and support. And Northern Australia has the highest rate of head and neck cancer anywhere in Australia. It's just appalling, the rate of head and neck cancer up there. Another positive is I interviewed a woman called Annie Taylor, who is an Aboriginal woman from a very remote community right up north in the Northern Territory in a little community called Borroloola. And she's employed by Cancer Council Northern Territory to support people in her local community to travel enormous distances to Darwin to be treated for radiation. And her position is funded by the local mining company. Now, I found that shocking because there are people alive in her community because she speaks language. She used to work as a nurse, as an Aboriginal health worker in in Darwin. And so she is able to support her local community to accept and attend and complete treatment. And yet that's not funded by the health system. You know, some research is being done to demonstrate the usefulness of that. So that to me shows we've got so much more to do at a practical level to close the gap. But the good news is Cancer Australia supported that webinar and is helping to support that work. And I think the current CEO of Cancer Australia is enormously committed to making a difference there.
Yeah, absolutely. Like we interviewed Dorothy Keefe. We had an OGC meets like this, Julie. And she was just not long after she was appointed. And I asked Dorothy, I've worked with Dorothy on a few projects in the past. And I said, what's your vision? What are your priorities? And she mentioned that the outcomes in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with cancer, that's her priority going forward. And they've started the National Cancer Plan and there's very much involvement with the Aboriginal community health organisations, and that will be a feature, and some of the jurisdictions are doing that. So I'm hopeful that if we were doing this in 10 years' time, that hopefully we will have made significant progress at a systems level.
We need it more urgent than that.
Yeah, I agree. We've got a five-year project here and working across Victoria, but, you know, it's already started, and I'm hoping that we'll see some quite significant changes. The Victorian Cancer Plan, which is a three-year plan, has priorities in there. So I'm not saying it will be 10 years, but, you know, we will look back in 10 years' time and go, wow, we have made progress.
Could I just say for your listeners, hear these words, cultural competency for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patients. Think, what the hell does that really mean? Please have a look at the webinar on closing the gap in cancer that I will share with you and give you the link, because we took a cameraman into the Aboriginal unit at the Royal Adelaide Hospital where Dorothy used to work. And you see it's an Aboriginal run centre and they have a myriad of practical things happening there that support Aboriginal patients to come to that hospital, have their cancer treatment, and most importantly, complete it. Because, you know, you have to turn up to every session to be safe. And similarly, we went to your town, Albury-Wodonga, to the Aboriginal Health Service with a cameraman, and we filmed that service, which has been designed and built and run by Aboriginal people. And you can see the sort of systems and visual design features that make it culturally competent. I mean, something as simple as many of the patients coming from Central Australia down to Adelaide, they come from really hot places and they come in the clothes they're in. And often in remote communities, people wear, yeah, they're not the best clothes in the world for a lot of people. So they've got a whole section in this unit right at the front of Royal Adelaide Hospital where there's all these really good clothes and people can come there and get their own clothes, get new clothes to wear. And that is, I'll be amazed if there's a non-Aboriginal service who thought to offer good clothes.
So we're running out of time. It's just been a wonderful conversation. I think I might know the answer to this question, but I just wanted to ask you what really inspires you and drives you now to get out of bed and keep going? Because it is amazing how you've turned your misfortune, if you like, into this great advocacy and doing good for others.
I look upon this question as an opportunity to thank everyone who's listening, who is in a multidisciplinary cancer team, who is a health administrator, a health policy person, who is doing what they can wherever they are to improve the early identification, diagnosis, treatment, and then ongoing support for recovery and rehabilitation. It's often called survivorship now, but survivorship's just rehabilitation to me. I want to say thank you for what you guys are doing, and particularly thank you if you're informing yourselves about how to form partnerships and work with patients and family, because when it comes to talking to politicians, as Head and Neck Cancer Australia will be doing, whoever's in power after the next election, about funding for research and improved treatment and head and neck cancer nurses, which is what I'd like to see as the prostate cancer and the breast cancer nurses have, because our need is so high. If you partner with us, we are very good at helping to communicate the urgency of the need for funding. I think we can reach the corporate sponsor, the political aid or minister. I also think we have some good ideas about improving care. I think the work I'm doing around the mask is important. But my main message is just thank you for the work you're doing, which is so hard during this pandemic, which is not over.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you, Julie, for all that you do. We didn't even mention Good News Week, so some of the younger listeners may have to Google that. They probably don't know what that is. I remember watching that lots of times. So you've had an amazing career, from gay activist to journalist, podcaster, media personality, comedian, and now I guess you're the most thing you're known for now is this advocacy in the cancer space. So thank you very much for what you do and for coming on the show. I'm sorry to Angus and Julia Stone. It's a great song, but it does trigger me. I'm sure they listen to the podcast. So any final last words, Julie, before we sign off?
Well, I just want to thank my cancer team at St. Vincent's Hospital, Sydney, and the Kinghorn Cancer Centre, because I'm now a regular carer for a little girl called Billy, who's 1.5, and I've lived to meet a grandchild. I want to thank my speech pathologist because I can speak to that grandchild. And I want to thank my dietitian because she helped me to eat enough that I was able to withstand the brutality of the treatment. So, you know, I just want to say thank you.
Fantastic, Julie. Hopefully we'll talk to you in the future about other issues. It's been wonderful, so thanks very much.
You've been listening to the Oncology Podcast. If you enjoyed today's edition and would like to subscribe, head over to our website, oncologynews.com.au, and sign up to our newsletter. Thanks for listening.